fire dependent, hired off to the class of 1962. If you're wondering if you're going to do any retirement, here I am.
Rick Laser, independent tree project, which is essentially the tree count for some kind of data. Put a box of form on June 23rd, 24th, and October.
Thanks for that, Ann.
Glenn Brown, I'm with the YouTube, and I'm just work on speech regulation, little kind of stuff that you just know what I'm doing, what the comments and what they're doing for the national.
More than the title, fourth foundation, that I do have to work here, and I want to do that, and I'm going to try to do it.
So why don't we take it from the top and work down?
Robert Tarr from the Research Director at Burson Center, and most of my time is spent looking at internet philosophy working with Victoria.
I'm Erica George. I work at Burson Center on the online community for the Top Agro Project. I also, in my personal life, work as a membership coordinator of Progressive Growth Factory here in Massachusetts.
If you've just come in, just quickly stop and introduce yourself. The two of you will call you. Where are you from? That doesn't quite work, Sam.
I'm from next to my birth in Ottawa, in Canada.
Good. Well, welcome to this session. We have just about an hour. Mika and I are going to kick it off, but we really do like to practice what we preach, and we think, especially hearing the interest that people have and the experience, we really want your input and thoughts into our discussion. I'm going to tell you a little bit about Sunlight, and Mika is then going to talk a little bit about what our sort of pull back a little bit and say what our overall strategy is. Sunlight was founded 2 years ago, really on the sort of riding the wave of two things. One, the worst recent congressional corruption scandals in terms of recent times. And secondly, the rise of new technologies and use of the internet, particularly in terms of the social web, which gave us sort of a confluence of opportunity to bring the internet in all of its dimensions, technological, networking, to the world of political information in particular. Our very first chunk of work that we did was to digitize existing political information. I've been a longtime follower of the issue of money in politics, particularly campaign contributions, And I know what an extraordinary task organizations like the Center for Responsive Politics do to get that information online, analyzed in a way that, reporters, bloggers, citizens can use it. The question is, how do you broaden that pool of information to include lobbying, revolving door, who worked for whom, when and where, government grants and contracts? All of the information our focus has been related to the work and or influences on Congress, although we're already beginning to expand into the executive branch regulatory agencies. And so our very first arena was the digitizing of existing political information. Well, you know, it's one thing to have databases created at an amazing nonprofit, but it's something else to make that information understandable. So the second piece of our work is to create new tools, websites, widgets, to make the information understandable. Because as much as I've spent time looking at databases, you know, it's much easier if I see a visualization of what, you know, what states are getting the most earmarks, for example, per capita. And when you do that, as we have done it, you see a very large circle for the state of Alaska. And probably you don't have to go any further than that. To, you don't even need to see Ted Stevens' name there. So, you know, the new tools that make it easy for people to, digest information. One of the websites that we co-founded in this arena is called opencongress.org, which not only makes information about legislation understandable and user-friendly, but it brings in streams of all kinds of other information, like what are the bills that are most blogged about, what are the pieces of legislation that are most written about in the mainstream media, and now has created a social networking feature on the site. So if you're really interested in the immigration bill or a jobs bill, you can go online, you can find other people who are interested in those issues. You can have conversations about bills. Just one example is a bill that I've never heard of about job, I think, creation. It has had over 800 comments on this piece, one piece of legislation. So the notion that citizens are interested in the, details of what's going on online, going on in terms of legislation is, kind of put to bed. So that's an example of a tool that makes it easy to use to digest information. Another example of that, particularly for folks who are in the journalism world here, has been to bring together these disparate streams of data that we have helped to facilitate through our funding or our own work into a single set, so that on a single web page, for example, you can see a profile of a member of Congress, and the public can analyze whether the earmarks that that member is requesting has any bears any resemblance to the largest political contributors, bears any resemblance to other grants and contracts in the state, bears any resemblance to a number of other data streams. So we're trying to bring this information together to make it more easy to understand and more intelligible. Third set of what we do is sort of the lobbying and advocacy side. We think it's government's responsibility to provide this data to citizens, not the nonprofit sector, to digitize it and make it available. And so we spend a lot of time on Capitol Hill developing an agenda and promoting that, trying to get pieces of legislation through. In that context, we sort of move into our fourth area of interest and expertise, which is community outreach. For example, the way it crosses over, someone on the Hill suggested that we create a model bill for government transparency. Which we did, picking up pieces of legislation that had been pending for a long time, writing new elements of it that we thought were critical. And when the staff came to me and said, well, take a look at this, what do you think? I said, my gosh, I'm not an expert on FOIA. We better call so-and-so, who is an expert, the Open the Government people, on FOIA. And then I said, oh no, let's just put it online, which we did. It's called publicmarkup.org. And at publicmarkup.org, we've had 120 people, some of them experts, but some of them ordinary citizens, come in to help us draft this piece of legislation. And so that's how these two pieces will come together. We will eventually take it down, and we will be the editors on this legislation, and we will take it to Capitol Hill to try to find some people who want to endorse it. But we now have a community of people who are engaged in this piece of legislation, so it's not just Sunlight promoting a comprehensive transparency bill. Maybe we can get, you know, 10, 15, 20 organizations to promote it with us. So the last two buckets in are the advocacy, what we do online and what we do on Capitol Hill, and the notion of community creation. In the latter category, We've held mashup contests for our data. We're very interested in that. And done a number of distributed research projects that have been quite successful, and we're learning a lot through that process. So that's what we do. I should say we do give grants. We have a very small grant-making budget. It's about $2 million out of our total budget for others to present to us creative ideas. Particularly, our largest chunk of that goes into databasing information that doesn't now exist. So let me introduce Mika Sifri.
Hi.
Talk about our overall strategy, what's behind it.
Well, I'm going to talk a little bit about our overall strategy, but I actually was hoping that this would just be a jumping off point to get a conversation going about the role of transparency in transforming government and you know, that broader theme of internet and democracy. And so what I thought I would do in just a couple of minutes is I guess talk about the theory of change that's underlying the work that Sunlight is doing, and then you know, maybe you'll want to react to that or offer other ideas about you know, what is changing and what we can do to perhaps move the process along in a productive way. Sunlight, I should say, you know, started with a pretty conventional notion from its founder, Mike Klein, who was upset by all the political corruption he saw going on in Washington and a lot of it not really being reported. And his original idea was to just fund more investigative journalism prizes. And Ellen took him around to meet a variety of top investigative journalists who all basically said the same thing. A bunch of new prizes isn't going to produce a lot more investigative reporting. The problem is that it's the cost of doing these kinds of projects is too risky for most of our employers. It's very hard to convince an editor to let you take a couple of months to go dig through files, and maybe you're not going to find anything, right? You may not end up with a story. And so that caused Mike and Ellen to sort of stop and rethink, and one piece of their rethinking was, well, maybe we have to move upstream and make it easier for people to get their hands on this critical information that if you could only get your hands on would enable you to tell more powerful stories about money and influence in Washington. And that's when I got involved, along with my partner Andrew Riche, in helping them think about the role of the internet in this process. And the big insight, I guess, we tried to apply was to look at what was already happening with the way that people were grabbing hold of the tools and the practices that were developing thanks to the declining cost of entry and the ease of use of all these new communications tools, and figure out where could we find some snowball to push down the mountain so that they could grow on their own. Where was the grain of the net already going, and where could a foundation like Sunlight inject some key resources to kind of speed up that snowball effect? We already have lots and lots of people who are digging on the things that matter to them and uncovering interesting information and then publishing it to the web. What can we do to make those people more powerful? What can we do to make it easier for them to get their hands on the information? What can we do to make that information more compelling? And so some of the things that we've thought about, obviously the first one is get it digitized so that people can get, you know, search from anywhere. There are certain, I'll give you one example. It used to be that if you wanted to get your hands on a member of Congress's personal financial disclosure statement, they have to file them once a year. And there was an office in the basement of Capitol Hill somewhere where you could go and look at the paper documents. That's disclosure according to Congress, but that's not disclosure in the internet age. So step one is let's move data online. Step two is let's make the data mashable. There's a lot of great data that sits in silos, and institutions like Open Secrets, like the Center for Responsive Politics, where you can go and do one search at a time, but you can't really grab all the data at once and sift it or combine it with maps or combine it with other things. And so Sunlight has made a condition of all of its grants to data providers that they have to build APIs, public APIs, application programming interfaces that will enable developers and people, this is obviously with some level of sophistication in how they use data, to mash it up and make amazing new visualizations or other kinds of storytelling that the web is uniquely capable of doing. The third thing is this notion of we've got to do the hard work of just training people, letting them know that these new tools are available, this data is available. So, you know, it's less glamorous than making a fun new widget or something, but I don't want to downplay the need to do training. We do a lot. We have two people who are currently traveling the country, talking and holding seminars for newspaper reporters in association with the Associated Press Managing Editors Association. By the time they're done, they'll have trained hundreds of reporters. We're doing the same thing with bloggers. Obviously, bloggers are just as much investigative journalists or can be investigative journalists if they want. And so we're doing the same kinds of outreach. Seeing these people as the people who will then reach larger audiences and uncover important information. The larger theory of change here is that most of the bad stuff happens because it's in the dark. And that Congress and lobbyists do what they do because they think no one is watching. And this is about changing that calculus. One way to expose wrongdoing is to, you know, hire Seymour Hersh and let him go, and that's a great model. But another way is to find 1,000 people and each give them a flashlight or put more batteries in their flashlights and maybe extend the analogy and help them all point at the things that they care about. And every now and then they will all point at the same thing. Yochai, who just entered the room, loves to tell this story. It's one of my favorite stories too. How the web loves a scavenger hunt. This is, again, think about pushing snowballs down the hill. When you tell bloggers that some member of Congress is blocking a completely common sense piece of legislation, like the idea of a federal database for all government spending and contracts, they want to know who it is. And they have a unique capacity to pressure their individual member of Congress because members are more responsive to constituents in some ways. And so when you say, which senator is it? Let's figure out who it is. People will do that very quickly. We've also seen if you structure research, Ellen talks about these experiments, and I'll end on this. One of the things that we've learned about the sort of distributed investigative model is you have to tune your approach appropriately to what the average person can kind of grasp. We learned this by mistake, by accident. Our first attempt was we got a list of all the earmarks in the transportation bill, I think it was, and we just published them all online and with a blog post saying, come on, join in, pick one, and if you can find anything out, you know, post it here. And a few people did, in fact, sink their teeth in a woman named Mrs. Pan Streppen, I think was her login name, discovered the Glaucoma Foundation, which had gotten $1.5 million earmark, 400,000 of which was going to its president, who was a former lobbyist. Clearly, something was fishy about that earmark. But the fact was, just giving people this big, hard task, here's a list of earmarks, find the fishy ones, that was too broad. So our next experiment, which worked much better, was we said, let's figure out which members of Congress pay their spouses from campaign funds, which is a completely legal thing to do. But in fact, it's how Tom DeLay put at least $500,000 in his pocket through money that he paid his wife and I think his daughter. And we structured the research so that people would log in, have a member of Congress's name assigned to them, click through to the page on Project Vote Smart where there was, they could scroll down and see if they had a spouse. Okay, you found the name of the spouse, enter it here, click. Now we take you to the page on Open Secrets, where that member's expenditure reports are shown. Okay, so we're holding the hand of the researcher, and we say, and the page said, now just scroll down and see if you can find the spouse's name. If you do, and there's a dollar amount next to it, enter that here, click, you're done. And now here's the key point. After the person clicked and said they were done, a screen came up that said, thank you, thanks to your help and that of others, we've already tracked down information on 75 members of Congress, and we've uncovered that, you know, five of them have paid their spouses, I don't know, $50,000 in total. Would you like to do another? So we launched this on a Friday afternoon on a holiday weekend with a blog post. It's probably the worst time. Ellen, I'm sure, was not happy.
She wasn't.
About the time of day that we were launching this thing, but it was ready, and she was pushing, let's get it out the door. So we got it out the door. By Saturday, midday, it was already half done. By Sunday, on this holiday weekend, all 435 members of Congress had been checked. I think we found 21 of them who had paid their spouses more than $300,000. We still had to check that information before we published it, but the project was done by a little bit over 100 people. I think we got in touch with the guy. One guy did more than 100 members himself. And we got in touch with him and said, who are you? Why did you do this? And he said, well, you know, I didn't have anything going on this weekend, and frankly, it was a little bit like eating potato chips. I couldn't do just one. and so the lesson of the story is that there is an energy out there. People do want to know. They do want to contribute to uncovering this buried information. Our challenge is designing new ways and better ways of making the information meaningful. This is actually, you know, one of the biggest challenges we face is there's a lot of data, but it doesn't necessarily all mesh together as neatly as you would like. And so we're in the thick of that now. But that's, I would say, I'll stop now. That's our theory of change about how the new availability of data and this increasing trend towards an expectation of transparency is going to help open up government and maybe make our representatives at least a little more accountable and perhaps a little less corrupt. I'd be quite happy if we had that result. So I think how much time? About till 12:15 or 12:30?
12:15.
Okay, so we have a lot of time. Just let's do it as a conversation, say who you are, and hopefully we can get a lot of issues on the table. Go ahead.
I'm wondering if
MDG
is wonderful work. There's a new tool that's been on the paper that's struggling with the edge of
I'm going to actually ask one of the other sunlight. There's several sunlight people now sprinkled in this room to take Greg. Introduce yourself.
Okay. My name is Greg Ellen. I'm the chief data architect at the Sunlight Foundation, and I came on board in May of 2006. My background is working with kind of weird distributed data, the small claim to fame is if you've ever looked on Twitter and the little notes you can make on images, that grew out of work that I was doing. So I'm trying to turn a photo into a video. So, but I think the point is that one of the things that we're having a lot of trouble doing is name standardization in order to make data interoperable across the different data sets. That's a huge problem, because what's very interesting in our scenario, or anyone who's working with government data, is we don't own the data. We don't have a lot of ability to create quality controls on how the data goes into the system. We're going to get the data from different resources, from different nonprofit groups, from different agencies, and we want to make that data interoperable. But there are no IDs on the data. You know, so the filings that are done with the FEC on, and, you know, campaign contributions and who your employer is, versus the filings that are done for procurement processes. And so it's not only the name standardization, but what is also companies owned, which companies own other companies. So this is a particularly nasty problem that we have. And we're looking into a few tools. We're trying to use active for names, for persons, trying to find some more. I think there are some enterprise class schools, but a lot of the enterprise class schools, a lot of enterprise class data sets of companies and other stuff are not readily available to us, or readily available to us that we can license it for other people to use.
I would just add that there's also another element here which we're struggling with, which is there is a piece to this which is also about enabling individuals to come together and act as their own watchdogs or as groups of watchdogs. And, you know, some of what we've done is thought about, you know, these projects like Congresspedia, which is a wiki on members of Congress, and Open Congress, which now has a personal site we call My Open Congress, where several thousand people have already registered and are participating in tracking the bills or the members or the votes that they're interested in, and they can comment and they can vote on things. And what we're searching for and haven't found, and I don't think anybody's invented the best tools yet, are really good tools for groups to deliberate together. A number of people have come to Sunlight over the last few years with proposals for projects like policy wikis, where everybody would somehow decide to get together and all talk about a bill or an issue and somehow come to some consensus. And for the life of me, I have yet to see any of these work. The only one that has had legs and had legs for a very specific reason is called Politicopia, which was started by a sitting member of the Utah State Senate, right, Britt? Yes. And House. Okay, the chairman of the Rules Committee, which means a powerful member of the House, and he created a wiki where legislation is posted in as it comes before the Rules Committee, but in advance of votes, and he's asking people to help parse it. And because he's a powerful member of the legislature, it's a meaningful place to have a conversation. You know, just throwing a wiki up on the web and saying, hey, everybody, let's use this as our tool for analyzing the content of this pending bill, it ain't going to work because you can't get people to come to that site. There's no reason for that to happen. And so I think, you know, there are struggles here about how you know, is it the tools, is it the community effect, and so we're searching for solutions there. Other comments, or, yeah?
I come from Chicago. First of all, I'm really interested in but I come from Chicago, which is before it was corrupt. Is there any plan or way for a lot of people to go over on that, like there's California stuff?
Yeah.
Is there a way to open these schools up and institute one hour there?
Well, some of the platforms are open source. So Open Congress, you could take the code for Open Congress tomorrow, as these guys did in Massachusetts, and create Open Illinois. And I know the guys at Open Congress would be thrilled. So, you know, anybody here who wants to do that, I don't know whether it maps directly to a city council, but it probably wouldn't be that hard either. The MapLight has ambitions to cover all 50 states. I don't know if Illinois is on their early list.
I don't know if it's on their early list or not.
You know, I think the truth is this is a big problem and we had to start somewhere. and, you know, the focus of Sunlight has been primarily Congress and Washington. You know, quite frankly, that's Mike, you know, the founder, you know, the first benefactor of the foundation, Mike Klein, that was his primary emphasis. The foundation does make small grants to local efforts, and, you know, it's sort of like a sprinkling of things, probably not at the level somebody would need to really take on Chicago politics.
Okay. Unless you use the open source software that already exists.
Yeah. Yeah, you do. I have to tell a story about Chicago, though. I just heard this, and this, I guess if it comes to me, it's it's okay. But there was a project in Chicago that was developed inside the Chicago city government to build a site called ChicagoWorksForYou.com. And it's archived on the web, so you can find it. And apparently, this was sort of a mashup of all the available city data. You could see how well the city was serving your neighborhood. And it was in the development stage, up to the point where the mayor's office had signed off on it. And there was like one last bureaucratic hurdle that had to be shown to all the aldermen. And the story goes that several of the aldermen looked at it and said, wow, this is really interesting, this is great. And then one of the founders, the guys who were working on it, said, yeah, and it's going live soon. And they said, no, it can't go live. And the reason was that they were afraid that if you showed people in a district that 90% of the service orders for like fixing potholes were being handled within 30 days, which presumably is a good rate, the aldermen were worried that the 10%, that their political opponents would use that. And they didn't want people to know. So we know there are obstacles within the power structure against this sort of information being available. I think this is the camel's nose under the tent, though, which is even if the government doesn't do it, we can do it to them. And some of the more forward-thinking mayors, I think Bloomberg, for example, is of the view that all this 311 data that the city has now, that his administration has pulled together, that they can make available for figuring out how city services are doing, that they are actually starting to make more of that available to the public. And here's his theory, as I understand it, is if the public latches onto this data, his successor will not be able to take it away. That if there's enough demand for this, then the politicians will have to follow, and it'll be institutionalized that you can know things like how well they're fixing your pothole.
And if you think the story that Mika told about the Chicago City Alderman is sobering, just imagine what the response is to Capitol Hill to a lot of what we're doing. So there's a huge cultural resistance, and our guess is that the pressure does come from below. You're used to getting this kind of, you know, information. You want more. You know, it's easy for you to email your member of Congress, what do you mean my email doesn't get through? And so pretty soon it becomes a demand that's irresistible. We'll work both ends of the spectrum, you know, but a lot of our work is into this community outreach to change the level of expectation of what government should provide.
Allison Parkson, Vermont Legislative. I'm just curious, when you said there's open source software, let's say our Secretary of State decided that they wanted to create Open Vermont, which I don't think it is. We have so much to do. We're very transparent in Vermont. You all know what we're doing. Maybe you learned it. So could the Secretary of State buy this something? How does
open source?
No buying.
So they could, in fact, do this now. There's a template they could get it.
That is exactly what happened in Massachusetts.
Ideally, they could improve it, too.
They could buy it.
They could improve on it. And if they did, they'd have to put the improvements back into the code for other people to use. Yeah, that's the definition of open source, free.
Yeah, just take a look at opencongress.org and whatever, you would have your own data streams to feed into that.
Yeah, I'm working it.
Okay, so I've been trying to track up.
Say who you are also, I'm sorry.
I've been trying to track up this subsidy for well over 10 years. And when governments get nervous about it, the thing they always do is they cut off the data flow. They recognize that transparency, you know, causes damage, and so they shut off the way to get the information. Have you seen that happen in what you try to do? And are there specific types of information or government agencies where that has been a particular problem?
Well, we have focused most of our work to date on Congress. So we don't have the depth of the expertise about, you know, what is government-wide information. But your general thesis certainly pertains. For example, We gave a grant to the Center for Responsive Politics to digitize the personal financial disclosure statements. Nita referred to them, been in the basements of some building in the Capitol, and now they're online. But they're only online back to 1995. So someone said, well, let's create a tool that makes this information more understandable. And we very quickly discovered that the personal financial disclosure statements for members of the Senate are actually destroyed completely, no copies, from 10 years back. So they keep 10 years worth, and then it's literally destroyed. So that's not good news. But we found on the House side, and this is the good news, that they're actually chronicled back to 1978 or 79, when the first disclosures were done, in books in the Library of Congress. And so one of our researchers went to the Library of Congress, and yes, indeed, Xeroxed every single one of those original forms. So there's no way we could have actually tracked it year by year. Subsequently, we discovered there's a problem with the data, which, of course, no one bothered to tell us or made available, was that the categories of, you know, worth that you would post your information in had changed dramatically. So we were still stuck with it going back only 11 years, to 1995. So the answer is, yeah. I mean, the government is not going to give up, for the most part, this information freely on its own. But it is beginning to change. One of our best examples, and I don't think we've talked about this yet, we gave a grant to a group called OMB Watch, an NGO in Washington, to create the first publicly available database of government grants and subsidies. They partnered with a for-profit firm, got the basic information, and created a great site called fedspending.org that's had over 7 million searches in the 20 or so months it's been available. So demonstrating some real usage. At approximately the same time, a bill was passed, Coburn-Obama bill, which required the federal government to create a nearly identical database. And so what did the federal government do besides gasp? By the way, the budget for the federal government database was $12 million, and our grant was for $320,000. So the government contracts with the nonprofit to purchase the licensing arrangement for their database, fedspending.org, and now is running an identical parallel database called usaspending.gov. So since that has happened, we've had inquiries and we hear rumblings of other government agencies that really would like to make some of their data more easily available. And so we will, of course, work with the staff at these agencies behind the scenes to try to make that happen. We're beginning to see a change in that, but there's a huge cultural resistance, particularly on the Hill, to revealing more information is absolutely necessary. Another ridiculous law, campaign finance reports have been required to be reported since, the 70s Campaign Finance Reform Act. In the House, they reported electronically. In the Senate, they reported on paper. And we cannot dislodge a piece of legislation that would require them to report it electronically. So we're working on that legislatively.
We were working this way. Okay, so Jim?
I'd like to support Representative Allison Carson's comment about the Vermont legislature. One might think that legislation in states like Massachusetts, New York, California, high-tech, relatively states with a better legislative website. No. Vermont's website completely outclasses.
Thank you very much. Now, I'm thinking all this is available. I mean,
it's incredible. Who would imagine a state, 120th the size of California would, completely outclass California, Silicon Valley, Massachusetts? It's great. Unbelievable. Now, I would also like to support the comment about Chicago as not a transparent. Remarkably untransparent. About a decade ago, I chaired task force for Vermont Secretary of State John Cooper on information democracy. As part of that, we did a survey of government access in Vermont. Now, Vermont has the best government access in the United States, largely because they get 5% of cable revenue. Most places don't pay, and it's allocated all the pay back to televising. The good old town council and whatnot. The average one was televised television. You know what? Back then, we had 8,500 seats. Now, who could believe? Now, go to Chicago, one of the biggest cities in the United States that doesn't have televised taxes. Why doesn't it? Because the mayor of Chicago, Mayor Daley, did a study, and he
doing a paper on comparative government access to population measures.
Okay, I studied.
I went to my city council in Chicago for months. I went to the person who told me they would not send me a copy of that. They were embarrassed by the study. The key point is what you would think the large, wealthy legislature would have the best website. Oh, it's these little towns in Vermont or the Vermont legislature. They, you know, outclass them. So I have a different question than that.
Okay.
Why did Sunlight start with the House as opposed to Senate versus what later?
Oh, that's easy. No, we pushed on an open door. The speaker.
Why don't we ask John to talk about it?
Yeah, John Wunderlich, he's the program officer who ran the Open House Project, actually.
Right, we're talking about something called the Open House Project. It's actually the Open House Project. .com.
The way that started was I was working as a salesman for a telemarketing company in Pennsylvania, and spent my time in the middle of the night talking about congressional information and their approach. And one of the people who was staff was happened to be, you know, the update that I was writing right after the 2006 election, and they said, we're starting to think about governance rather than politics, because we just won, now we have to decide what's more. The last time the rules were really considered this mentioned for right after the 2006 election, they read those essays and they said we would really like to see a public determination of what people online can perceive in Congress and what we want to know as part of the plan. So really that experience really is how I ended up becoming a lobbyist at CCC and moving into the public access community and working with so much foundation. And so the Open House Project really grew directly out of the research in the middle of the night and teaming up with all the American people, so much foundation, and Pelosi staffers being open and inviting people about how their information is available online. So it really kind of grew over the next year.
Right, but it's critical to mention
much more of a, not as pressure.
That it's a cross-partisan project. So the fact that the speaker endorsed it, obviously tremendous, but also the minority leader, and the when Sunlight funded the Open House Project as this open discussion for how to improve how the House would make information available on the web and otherwise use the web, we had four co-chairs, two Republican, two Democrat. I mean, you know, that we really wanted it to be a balanced discussion. And so if you look at the product, I think there's something going on with the notion of transparency being a cross-partisan concern. And they may have different reasons for it. I fully understand. You know, the Republicans may be using it now because it gives them something to say to hit the Democrats with. And the Democrats may, you know, whatever. It doesn't really matter. Because if the end product is that they can both agree that committee hearings ought to be, you know, webcast, and committee websites ought to contain the transcripts of committee hearings, which are things that they didn't used to do and are only starting to do, it's a net plus. So, you know, we have tried to engage the insiders, and some of them are beginning to shift, maybe not as much at the local level as they ought to, but, you know, I think we're watching something in motion. Okay.
And we do hope to launch an open Senate project shortly.
Yeah, okay, here and then there. I'm sorry, we're going to work our way. Okay, go ahead. Say who you are.
I'm Chris Daly from Boston University. I teach journalism there. And I'm interested in your editorial process internally, because in traditional media, you know, like legacy media, when you do an investigation and wrap it up and divulge it to your audience, that's a pretty big moment in the life of your organization. And they're very careful about it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so you finish it, first you have to edit it. And then you can also lawyer it and run it past your attorney. Do you do things like that, or how do you handle that? Those issues around accuracy and protecting yourself from libel and
Well, the investigative side of what we do is not one of our major pieces. I mean, our fundamental piece that contributes to that is the creation of the databases that enable all kinds of investigative reporting to go on. So writ large, that's out there, that's in the public. But we do have two investigative journalists on staff. We have a site called Real Time Investigations, in which they blog about ongoing investigations ongoing either investigations or research that might lead to potential, in-depth investigations. And then occasionally they do sort of something they're working on. They will pull back and they will investigate and will break a story on the web. For example, one of our biggest stories that we broke was the story that Dennis Castor owned a piece of property within a couple of miles of an earmark that he advocated for and won. He very shortly there after that earmark to, I think, approve a highway, sold this piece of property, and sort of within 8 or 9 months, he was $2 million richer. Dennis Hastert is, no longer a member of Congress, as we all know, and I wouldn't say that investigative piece caused him to think about not running again, but it sure made life less pleasant for him.
Well, his staffer did threaten to sue us for libel.
Yeah, and that's when we got our libel lawyer.
But we were hoping he would sue, actually.
But we have two very experienced people who, come from the Center for Public Integrity who are working with us, and so we pay attention to that. And the distributed projects, which are, much lower key, sometimes we will fact check them, but sometimes we'll say, members of Congress, if we've got this wrong, we did an investigation of members' websites, for example. Citizens participated, we said, grade them or evaluate whether, figure out whether these five or six items are on their website. And we just let it go, and members of Congress came out of the woodwork and said, yes, we do post our earmark requests, and here where they are. So again, sort of involving, lawmakers. Those are not mistakes. Nobody's going to sue us over that because they had the opportunity to correct it. We have a site, one of our first sites, a joint project with the Center for Media and Democracy called Congresspedia. It's a wiki on Congress, and we have two full-time editors who monitor everything that's going on. We have rules about sourcing. I should add, something I put up here is, on top of the Congresspedia, we have a project called the Superdelegate Transparency Project, which was a very early attempt to follow where the superdelegates for the Democrats are going. And it's been described fairly recently as being more accurate than the New York Times count. And that's because it's more timely. I mean, it literally happens, all day and all night in terms of our things.
There's a woman back there? Yeah.
The answer to your question is that the third time in 3 days people have asked for our help on international, moving sort of into the international arena. We have not done so yet. I mean, I think we're at the mode at the moment of trying to sort of assess what our best practice is, and we're probably best in sort of, talking about those kinds of things. But the, our love is the U.S. and Congress, and to the degree we begin to expand, it's executive branch, it's potentially state and local, and we're just beginning to sort of poke around in the international arena and figure out what we could possibly contribute, in that arena. We're very, excited about the potential. We see particularly in Congress, at the staff level, and the executive branch, at the senior staff level, a lot of excitement for what we're doing, but we have a long way to go to change the institutional resistance to making government data freely available. And until you have the source and the flow of information, then you have a fairly expensive process, sometimes of actually databasing, taking paper records and having people type in the information into databases. When we can get it electronically, it's obviously much cheaper and much faster. But you've got to start with what kind of data is initially available. And, we're at the tip of the iceberg, I think, in terms of the executive branch regulatory agency. And we still don't have everything we need out of Congress in the form and format we want it.
Mm-hmm. they're working their way this way now. Questions? Comments? Yeah? You? Yeah?
I'll take the resource part. Sunlight is probably this year about a $5.5 million operation. $2 million of that goes in grants to other organizations. And the mission at the moment is Congress and the work of Congress. So we can move into grants and contracts. But we see ourselves expanding next year, and I don't know what that budget looks like, into the executive branch in a big way. So that's sort of on the horizon. What it would take, you know, to move beyond that into state and local and into, you know, some of these other arenas that you're talking about, I think is an unknown at the moment. So that's the resource question.
Yeah, in terms of business, I mean, there are a couple of places where things intersect, okay? First of all, business lobbies. Business gives money to campaigns and so on. So in the course of focusing on peeling away all these layers of the onion surrounding Washington and Congress, you're inevitably looking at, you know, the 10,000 biggest corporations in America, okay? They're all big donors, they're all paying lobbyists. So we are, as a byproduct of all this work, one way to zoom in on the information will be not, you know, the member of Congress, but instead, you know, the Fortune 500 company. You know, who are they giving to, who's flying on their jets, you know, what government grants and subsidies are they getting, who have they hired, who used to be congressional staffers. I mean, these are all pieces of the picture that need to be exposed so that people can figure out what's actually going on. So that's number one. We are, you know, with the prospect of a new administration, and I think at this point it's safe to say whoever the next president is, all of the candidates still in the race are talking about making the government more open in some interesting ways. And so we're looking at doing some work between now and the end of the year to flesh out what the next president can do, even just with executive orders. People may not realize that there's quite a bit that agencies can do in terms of requiring disclosure. For example, that you know, the SEC is a great example of this. So to just take your FCC example, what if, you know, every license holder before the FCC was required to disclose directly its spending on lobbyists, its campaign contributions, and to do that, you see, right now the onus is on the recipient, not on the giver. And its meetings with FCC commissioners, you know, that's where the real lobbying happens. So we think there's a lot that could be done by executive order. We think there's at least a decent chance that whoever the next president is, that we could see some progress there. I mean, of course, there'll be resistance, but another piece. The last one is, you know, some of the tools we finance or help finance with, in partnership with others, they work across the spectrum. The one that I find most interesting is something that CREW, the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, is starting to build on their own. They do all these FOIA requests against the White House, and they get these huge data dumps, thousands and thousands of papers, and they issue a report based on that data, but then they have all this raw government, you know, detritus, and it's memos and it's meeting records and so on, and they don't have the resources to go through it themselves. So they started building something called Open FOIA, and Sunlight then came in and gave them more support to finish this out as a repository for anybody who's got government raw material out of FOIA requests. You can put it there, and then the idea is anyone can sift through it and help mark up the pages. So you could go and read, you know, something about Jack Abramoff's meeting with, you know, the Secretary of Interior, and there are interesting names in these. The documents are all PDFs, right? It would be very expensive to turn them into searchable text searchable. But somebody can go through and mark down, you know, in and turn these documents into searchable data. And so that project is quietly humming along, and of course could use, you know, more support from all kinds of places.
I think it's actually called, is it govdocs.org? governmentdocs.org? governmentdocs.org. So, and there are about five or six organizations that are participating. Just to embellish one of Mika's points, the notion, I mean, how we move into that, you know, how did the corporation relate to the campaign contributions? We've had the vision of something we call the influence matrix, where literally you can look up a company name or a member of Congress name and see all of these relationships in one very easy to digest visualization. We've got to, as Greg mentioned earlier, there's some really sort of knotty problems there, which is, you know, the names are not the same in all the databases, and so it's a big problem to wrestle with, but that is, it's often described actually as Ellen's vision of one-click disclosure. We're not quite there yet. We have time. Yeah, I think, Rick, maybe you get the last question.
Okay. You believe the Fortune 535 is the key means and frames it very well. And so providing sites for each congressional district, so we have a site for people in each congressional district. We understand that the problem for people who don't know those districts are going to be like that. And there are people who are exercised about something, whether it's a freeway or whatever, to corral the Congress critter. People have all the money to vote, but the Congress critter don't find that way. 1,000 people, see where it's like, 1,000 people in any district in the country, totally interested.
I'll take 500.
Okay. I'll take 400.
500 people networked together. If, you know, when Jimmy Wales says that five people working continuously on one of the minor language wikis can make that wiki a viable site in the Wikipedia universe, and I think if I could get, you know, 5 or 10 people per congressional district deciding that they're going to watchdog their member of Congress using all these tools and also, you know, posting on the web what they're finding. I think that, you know, we're not that far away. I wouldn't set the bar so high, actually.
There is this almost pent-up demand.
Yeah.
Who would have believed 7 years ago that so many people have spent so much time, energy, and money managing their music for it? And yet people go in, they learn all this, even though what a genre it is for that. And so I think there's a lot of ability, a lot of open capability. Play turkey, play this thing.
Sure.
All this extra capacity out there to do these things. Here's the farm mission. We just give them votes. Our newgov.us is essentially a distribution channel for Sunlight Data.
Great.
Perfect. So, if you want to continue this conversation, I'm doing one at 2 o'clock. We're not going to be interested. And so we've got the same conversation as we keep going.
Okay, and just, I'm going to end with an advertisement. If there's anybody in the room who codes and wants to contribute in helping make things with all the tools and data that we're working with, make sure to say hi to Greg Ellen, our chief data architect. We have the we didn't mention this. Sunlight has its own internal labs, Sunlight Labs, about 6 full-time and a couple of part-time people, coders and designers working on making stuff and also providing technical support to other grantees. And you know, one of our visions here is that other people who have spare cycles, as Britt was suggesting, who want to play, come and play with us. So thank you. Looking forward to continuing the conversation.
Two quick logistics notes.